myself out.
I am afraid of...
I'm terrified and paralyzed by...
I am deathly afraid of...
Welcome to the Sum of All Fears podcast with your host, me, Ryan Perio. Hello, and welcome to the Sum of All Fears podcast. I am your host, Ryan Perio. This week, it's the 4th of July, and with that, we have a guest comic, Tim Davies, joins the show. Tim is a new comic here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. He's just working with the Claws Out Comedy Group, and he's been, you know, kind of starting to make his way in the comedy scene. In this episode, we talk about his start in comedy, how he met his wife, and we talk about teaching and all the different entertainment realms that he's kind of danced in. Like, he's been a magician, a rapper, a musician, and now a comedian. And so we get into that, and then we get into his fear of losing his memory. So let's get into the interview right now with Tim Davies. All right, my guest this week is comedian and podcaster Tim Davies. Tim Davies is a new local comic here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. He also has his own podcast called Shift Space, where he talks about lighthearted political discussions with his guest. Tim, how are you doing today?
I am doing magnificent today. Just got done playing some Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 1 and 2.
So did you complete 1 and now you have to start 2? Is it like a saga game that, like...
It's anthological. You kind of beat each skate park, or sometimes it's like a school or a, you know, stadium or something, and you got to like progress through each different place you skate. So,
are you a skater?
I am not. I am actually terrible at it. I thought for a while that I could pursue it. I even like put together my own board in college so I could get around, and never really used it.
Okay. That's interesting. I would have never thought of you as like a skater.
Which is accurate.
Did you listen to Skater Boy a lot, like as your youth? Was that your anthem?
Skater Boy, Complicated, Avril Lavigne, big fan.
I see a couple of guitars in the background. How avid of a musician are you?
I'm a pretty avid musician. I have about a dozen instruments or so. I'm not really amazing at any of them. My best is probably the keyboard. But yeah, all the types of guitars, ukuleles, I played trumpet and all that. So yeah, big enthusiast.
How did you get into music?
I was in middle school band. I felt almost like an obligation because my brother was in middle school band and I followed in a lot of his footsteps. And then I took piano lessons with like my church's piano player.
So, okay. So yeah. you got real proficient at it, and it's just kind of, you've carried that on through your life.
Right. It's something I've always kind of done as a hobbyist. I actually had a couple of years in college where I was recording rap music.
Oh, wow. So you were spitting bars?
I was spitting bars. I think my probably most played song only is like 20,000 plays on SoundCloud. But, you know, it was something. It was certainly weird to look back on. There's some really embarrassing cover art that I created and was proud of at the time that I was looking at today. And was like, oh, God, why was that a lifestyle choice I made? But
did that come up in your Facebook memories today? Is that why that just popped up? Is that something that...
Yeah. It was so... one of the art, it was a silhouette of my head with a snapback on backwards. Mm-hmm. And then the silhouette was kind of like filled in with mountains. And the title of this, like my first EP, was Make War, Not Love. So really cringy. But, you know, I think we've all got some of that in our past.
Mm-hmm. Could you have used any of your lyrics in your wedding vows? Like, could you...
Oh my gosh, that would have been perfect. I hadn't even considered it.
Like, that's your wedding song? You just throw that up?
Yeah. I did make a lot of connections when I was in music. I was on this Making Hip Hop subreddit, okay. And I got connected to a Facebook group through that. And some of those guys have gone on to produce pretty popular music. Alas, not I.
But so. That's cool. That's still something, like I said, to be like included in a group that has, you know, taken that next step and things like that. To, you know, just to even be around it. Like I've used to be, when I first got out of high school, I used to be a cook and a chef. And some of the chefs that I worked around are like executive chefs in Dallas and stuff. Like they were on Top
Chef.
Oh,
that's awesome.
Like I've seen some of the people that I work with on Top Chef, you know, competing. And I'm like, that's just true, you know, finding your passion, you know, and knowing that and being in that kind of industry, you kind of know if it's your passion or not. Like it does kind of give you signals of, oh, I'm not as dedicated to this as that guy. That guy is out here just like 3 a.m, like, you know, just playing with this one little beat. And
So it definitely was somewhat of like a wake up call seeing these other people kind of make it. And I didn't have as much heart in it, but I love it as a hobby. I did not know you cooked. Wife and I are really big Food Network fans.
Okay. What is your Food Network show?
We like Guy's Grocery Games. At least that's my personal favorite. Wacky. We also like Chopped as well, and Cutthroat Kitchen.
Okay. See, I started with Chopped when I first moved out. Like that was my big show. It was like I would watch Chopped and I could pick out, okay, truffle oil guy, you're gone. Like you could tell what mistakes. Like me and my uncle, I didn't watch Top Chef till season 2. That's like my favorite show. And so we watched the season 2 and we're both chefs and we're like going through and they're, you know, talking about the stuff and like there's no way. You know, like we're looking at each other, there's no way he's gonna recover from this. And we would pick, like episode 1, we would pick our chef, I guess, horse, if you will, to see if they're the ones that are Top Chef.
That's good. You off the outset, you just judge them, just look at them like, who's their vibe?
Yeah, and like just the attitude, like, because there's always people that are curmudgeon and that they have to have drama. Like one of the local chefs here, John Tassar, was on he was on 2 seasons of Top Chef, and like the first year they made him just kind of seem like just an arrogant asshole. And I'm like, but
there's some
like
great editing.
It just I get it. Like they just wanted him to kind of basically, you know, put his foot, you know, almost like, can you be the guy that says that, you know, kind of almost things like women should be barefoot in the kitchen or something like that? Can you be that guy? That just vocally unlikable person.
But he's spot on reality TV.
Yeah. But he's an amazing chef. Like he owns Knife and in Dallas. That's one of his big restaurants and stuff where they just dry age beef and stuff like that. And it's amazing. He's like an amazing chef. And then the second season that he goes on, they kind of mellowed him out. But like that first season, he was just so like abrasive. It's like, man, I would hate to be in that position where you kind of want exposure, but at the same time, don't expose me as just like the worst sides of me.
Yeah.
Or at least give me some of the solid sides. Like show me some of the good things about my life. Don't just make me out to be like this, you know, almost, you know, out of, you know, I'm an older chef, so I'm just almost out of the game. So there's this.
Yeah. You're washed up a little bit of a. Yeah.
Like you're just kind of hanging on. I'm like, you're in a, you know, competition with some of, you know, the most, you know, notable chefs. And so it's real fascinating to watch. Like I haven't finished this last season. Like I have the last episode because I constantly and at open mics and stuff. So I usually get home and then for some reason I'm in my current state, I'm sleeping like all hours and not, you know, not really, you know, able to just sit down and watch a show. And so I've kind of, you know, held off on that one. Every time I'm like, I think about watching it, it's like, okay, I got to go to sleep and then I'll wake up.
I like going back and watching like old reality TV as well. Stuff from like the early 2000s where things were a little different. I recently going through a show called Solitary, which effectively they take like 8 or 9 contestants and they put them in a, like 8x8 room and they're just there for weeks on end and they just do different like tasks, which are effectively torture. And whoever like, you know, wimps out the first gets eliminated. But you don't know like which person gives up on each task first. So you just have to endure these terribly cruel things. And they do the same thing with some of the people. Like they edit some of these people to look like terrible people, really like gym bro. You know, you got your gym bro guy. Mm-hmm. You've got like your yoga instructor woman. So they like to cover those bases.
So how did you, I guess, find stand-up like out of all of this? And then how did you kind of end up in the comedy scene?
I've always kind of been a natural performer and entertainer. It was really obnoxious kid in the classroom. I know a lot of comedians probably fall in that same category. I would do a lot of talent shows. I would do magic. I would do juggling. I did one time where I like ripped a bunch of Stephen Wright jokes and did those along with some of my own original one-liners. I was like 10, you know. But I finally kind of entertained the idea, you know, years and years later. When I was 18, I wanted to do it, but just didn't put my foot through the door. And finally, this past year, I'm 26 now. This past year, I kind of let that worry go, just went for it. Did a mic. I think the first one, Funky Picnic, and then I did like Twilight Lounge the next day. And I obviously got in good there, and it's been fun. I really enjoy it, and I can incorporate a lot of my different weird talents into the act. I like, you know, sometimes I'll throw in like a random magic trick. So I do a joke about being a recovering magician and stuff like that. I got a character that uses a yo-yo, not well because I can't do it well, but yeah, I just natural entertainer, and I love it. I fell in love with it. Got the bug.
Okay, so you're a one man glee club. Is what you're trying to say.
Essentially, yeah. Yeah, I was in theater and band and all that.
So how did you meet Mrs. Davies?
So we met on Bumble.
Okay.
That's like a little online dating story. The great piece of the story, though, is that on our very first date at a coffee shop, the first interaction we have, first thing she says to me, she calls me by the wrong name.
Okay.
Yeah. So I walk up to her. She turns around. You must be Chris. I am not Chris. That's just the last guy she was talking to, like on Snapchat. And those are the words that came out of her mouth. Small coffee shop. The barista heard everything. And I turned it around. I mean, I'd like to think.
Well, it seems so far, so good. Like,
yeah.
Do you still go by Chris sometimes? Like, call me Chris. Yeah.
Under the covers. Like,
it's Saturday night. You know what to call me, Chris.
But I love telling people that because it's just fun.
Well, I mean, that's just the modern dating thing is that there's so much input, and I just don't know if I could ever. I'm just kind of one of those people that just basically I would say easygoing would be the way people would probably define it. Mm-hmm. I don't really have a lot of, I guess, highs and lows. So I'm very go with the flow.
Okay.
And so I don't get real like super hype or super like down. So I'm very much deadpan, I would feel like, as far as
even keeled.
Yeah. Even keeled. Yeah. Like I've just gotten to a place where I'm somewhat, I would say, content, but I'm not where I feel like I have to do this or there's something more is riding on this working out.
Yeah. And parts of me wishes that, you know, I met Katie in like an organic way or something like that. But I think it's just statistically, I think most people are meeting on dating apps now.
Well, I mean, technically you did meet her organically. Just because you talked to her online doesn't mean.
Right.
It's just you, you know, that's just that online thing facilitated.
Yeah, it's the medium,
yeah.
I suppose. It's just the new medium because we're not, you know, I always like to think, you know, like way back when you have something arranged and you would like write letters and stuff like that. I suppose it's just the same thing with a modern facade over it. Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. So you guys have, you know, taken that interaction and turned it into a life together. And that's...
That's, yeah,
you know,
it's amazing.
It's just what it is. I mean, it's just that's how dating works. Is sometimes is just you meet somebody, and it, even if the things don't go 100% right, you know it's worth it. It's worth pursuing more. It may have not been like you said, storybook romantic.
Yeah, but I will say I did end up reading her some of my original poetry on this first date. And funny enough, I think that is that in my like just charisma, I think was really what got it. But
okay,
funny looking back at that was like my move. Like I was like, you know what, first date needs is me reading my original poetry.
You know what's missing?
A little self involved.
You know what's missing from these rom coms? Poetry.
This is not enough. There's not enough poetry in this world. They just need more slam.
So you're like Mike Myers. Do. So I Married an Axe Murderer. You're the slam poetry.
I actually did a bit of slam in college at A&M. There's a place in Bryan, Texas called Revs. And every Sunday they would do slam poetry. And it was sort of a variety thing too. I embarrassingly did perform some of the rap music there as well. Not like it went bad or anything. Just looking back, you know, it was certainly a choice I made.
So if you have a child and he gets into rap, and are you going to pull out the rap albums and then see how he reacts to his father's?
Of course.
Okay.
Yeah, of course.
Are you going to play
I'm not
going
to. I'll open it up.
Yeah. When his date comes over or her date comes over and you just kick on your like you're talking to him. Like, hey, man, you ever rap? Let me show you some. And then you just click on the music from SoundCloud. Like, that's me.
Who is this? You know, yeah. I actually used to do some freestyle for students because I teach. Mm-hmm. And when I was substitute teaching, I was kind of known around the school for freestyling. And kids would, like, record it and put it on social media and stuff like that. And it got a lot of positive attention and kind of helped me connect to the students, especially because I'm already so young and I look so young. It kind of helped form a connection.
Okay. You're actually the cool kid as a teacher is what you're trying to say.
Right. I'm coming around. It didn't, we had to get through magic and band and choir and all that growing up, but I self-actualized eventually.
Okay. Do you do magic to the kid for the kids? Like do you do?
I do. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Not like often, like it's not like a gimmick or thing I do often, but just for fun, like at the end of the year on like testing days and stuff, like, or randomly. I always like to mess with kids and like, you know, make things
show them like the a sheet like they got an A, then it just turn it around and it's an F. It's just and then hand them their grade. Ta-da.
Oh, that would be great. I think I could pull that off.
Just basically do like a little sleight of hand, like, oh, your grade is looks like an F. Oh. How, as a teacher, what is the struggle like nowadays? Because I was like, you know, from when I was a kid, there was like parent-teacher conference. Like, so when you have a child that, I don't know if they call it failing anymore, like, I guess they would be like struggling.
So at risk.
At risk.
Of not graduating.
Okay. What grade do you teach? Like, what do you teach high school?
So I teach high school, 10th through 12th grade. The program I'm in is called IMPACT. It's for students with autism spectrum disorder. They're high functioning. A lot of them will be in AP classes. Some of them won't be. They'll be in like resource classes and stuff like that. But it's a pretty wide spectrum that I get.
Okay. So yeah, that it's such a diverse. I would say education is such a diverse thing now. It doesn't like when I was a kid. It was you know you were responsible for everything, and they didn't have like these like I guess. Abilities to capture things that mental struggles and things that emotional that kids struggle with now, and they kind of almost tailor because there's like Montessori, there's all kinds of different educational
there's a big push for social emotional learning, SEL as it's known, kind of what you're talking about there, and that is sort of the idea that we'll focus on these aspects of them so that they're fully well-rounded, like you're saying, like the Montessori programs. You're not just working on a kid's academic ability, but their social skills and their abilities to function as like not assholes in society, ideally.
Yeah, where was that in my growing up? Because like, I'm probably somewhere on, I would say, on the spectrum. There's no mm-hmm. way I could be this even keel without it, without that.
Uh-huh.
Like, there's just something there that just keeps me locked in, you know, mm-hmm. just kind of this, you know, very much, you know, I'll have little outbursts and things that I'll keep under wraps, but there's just, it's just, there's something there because it's like, there's so much that I've like little things that was like, well, maybe it's this, maybe it's bipolar, maybe it's, but it's like, there's so many other things that I had that I'm like, that doesn't fit. Like the shoe didn't fit.
Right. I also struggle with a lot of different issues, and it's hard to identify because I've gotten all these labels. When in reality, I imagine there's just like one or two singular things that are actually wrong with my brain. Mm-hmm. We just aren't where, you know, scientifically, we're not somewhere psychologically to describe those things yet. So I definitely fall neurodivergent. I don't know if I necessarily fall on the spectrum per se, but my coworkers sometimes like to think so.
They seem to have their own theories as to what.
Yeah, they have their own theories. I also am on the board of the Education Foundation for that mm-hmm. school district, the Chisholm Trail Education Foundation. So we also get to fund a lot of innovative programs that teachers use for social emotional learning or robotics or whatever. So I'm happy to be in a position where I am kind of pouring in to a school and just to students. It's also the school and the school system I grew up in, which is both sad and cool at the same time.
But yeah, I just always... It's one of those things where I see it and it's like some of the things I wish they would teach in school. Like I wish they would have a psychology, like a broad overview of psychology to kind of educate kids on the impact. Because I was, as I've told other people on podcasts, is like, I feel like people that are in charge of education don't fully grasp like the psychology involved in growing up in school,
yeah.
Because it's like, it's easy as adults to say there's a million people in the world and to realize now where all the other things are, like, because in school and junior high, your world is 200 kids. It's only 200.
Yeah.
It's not the world. People always like put the adult thing on it. Like, you know, there's millions of people out there. Yeah. But I only interact with 200 of them. And
yeah.
And if I'm miserable in this world of 200 people, I'm there for 3 to 5 years,
yeah.
Depending
day in,
on which,
day out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it also is really dependent on where you're at and like the system that you're in, like the, yeah. you know, geographically or socioeconomically. And I agree. I think we do need to put more focus on some of the psychological aspects and sociological aspects that surround schools.
Yeah, because it's your formative years. These are the things that basically mold and shape your, I guess, who you're going to be as an
yeah.
adult and the things that you carry. And it's just something that, you know, as kids, like you would wish that they would actually, you know, understand sometimes the impact of just constantly talking about or berating just one or two people every single
yeah.
day, and just, you know, just to kind of give them that realization that, hey, though those three, you know, even if they're not the worst things that were, like, it's not like I wish you would die or anything like that, if it's just
yeah.
just even little critiques can lead to constant, you know, just constant social dynamics of not having long hair, or, you know, not wanting to wear a dress, or not wanting to wear shorts. Things like this, little things like that, that just kind of have a huge impact on people's lives, and they just don't. I don't think they realize it, and you realize it like 20 years later. And even then,
yeah.
sometimes you'll run into your bully from middle school or whatever, and they'll be like, I had
yeah.
no idea. And I used to have a bit about bullies that they should get a psychology degree. That if you wanted to stop bullying, they would teach them psychology and they would have to fix everybody they broke.
Ooh, I like that. Yeah, I had a middle school bully, and at the time I was really bad at handling emotions. And there was so much going on in my home life that I internalized and like wasn't working through with anybody. And I think that certainly affected my trajectory in a lot of ways. Ultimately, I think I landed in a good spot, but it really took years and years and years to get through some of those things. They'll still affect me as far as some social anxiety or just really weird negative things I'll tell myself and worry about. Thing I always come back to with students is I wish as a teacher I could impart perspective. And you can to a degree. You can explain this is just your life now. When you get out into the world, it's going to be different. There'll be more people, more opportunities, you know, particularly with students that get in really depressive episodes and have suicidal ideation and things like that. You just wish you could show them that there is more to life, but you're the narrow, the myopic, narrow kind of vision and perspective they have, it really, unfortunately, can't always be expanded without experience. And that's unfortunate. You have to go through negative experiences in life sometimes, I feel, to get that perspective. But I think we could get closer. You could at least get a little closer to showing, you know, understanding kids and showing them, you know, having give them hope.
That and just also giving people the okay to, if something's wrong, don't take it out on somebody else. There are professionals that you can take it, you know, that you can unload that on rather than to see either the awkward looking girl walking down the hall and, you know, putting it on her to make yourself feel better, to step on that person, to climb that little social ladder.
To go back to, I think, your initial kind of question on it about the problems kind of in school nowadays, I think the big one is, you know, after coming out of COVID and all of that, and being desocialized and not having the same social interactions, I think most teachers find that behavior is a lot worse and kids are a lot more abrasive or less willing to do work, which already was a problem. And it was like with technology, but it's been exacerbated even further by that lack of socialization. I think it was important that we had hybrid learning and distance learning. At the same time, you're missing so much of a social component that I think does cause and worsen some of those things like bullying and because you're less empathetic and things like that, unfortunately. Yeah.
And so it's interesting, like I said, since we're talking a lot about mental scope and stuff, because your fear kind of falls on there. Go ahead and tell the listenership what Tim Davies is afraid of.
Goodness gracious. My biggest fear would easily be losing my memory. Particularly like Alzheimer's or progressive degenerative, a kind of neurological disorder like that. My grandfather had Alzheimer's and it significantly, obviously, impacted his quality of life. He was in memory care at the end of his life. He was a fall risk. He fell a couple of times. And, you know, I think that the day after his last fall or something is when he passed away. His wife, also ended up in a memory care facility, not with Alzheimer's, but just dementia in general. Because Alzheimer's, I suppose, is a specific disease versus just dementia. So it's hereditary. And I just seeing these people lose their memories slowly over time, looping in conversations, forgetting who people are, it scares the living daylights out of me. I really cherish my memory. I've got a very good memory. Really good recall, vivid recall. And it's one of the most important things to me. And without it, I don't know what I would do. I wouldn't want to be around. I don't know.
Yeah. It's definitely something, again, that I have a gift for. It's something that's helped me in life and helped me in my job, just being able to hear certain things and immediately recall what issues are and things like that. Like, oh, that, I know how to fix that. When you told me that, I remember this is the fix for that. I don't know why it's the fix. I just remember that this will work.
Yeah. I read, I hadn't put a name to it yet until recently, because I was kind of reading up on it for this discussion. It's a thanatophobia is the term for the fear of you losing your memory, but specifically in extreme cases, I suppose, like literally anxiety and panic attacks occurring from it. I'm not at that level, although I do have panic attacks and anxiety attacks as well that I suffer with. I'm just afraid as I get older, I could really suffer from something like that. As you know, the bell tolls and I, you know, march closer, you know, in my 60s or something like that, I could picture that being a big fear. I really hope there is research that will be able to counteract or, you know, something that'll be able to counteract memory loss.
Yeah. It may just be a thing of you just constantly just, that's just the world. It's certain things, you know, just strip away is aging and stuff like that. Like, it just, things don't run like they used to. And so, you know, what used to be, you know, cream crisp, like, you know, routines are just all of a sudden, what was I doing?
Yeah. I read this study that Stanford is doing about memory loss and memory care. Mm-hmm. And they actually took spinal fluid from younger mice and put it into older mice. Mm-hmm. And it actually improved their cognitive functioning. That sounds very dystopian. Like, yeah. Taking the spinal fluid of the young and putting it in the old, but it looks promising, and there's a lot of things going on that I think are promising for mm-hmm. memory loss, but who knows? Maybe I need to take alpha brain supplements. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I take some supplements. Like, I do a lot of vitamins and stuff because I'm 45, and so I'm just like, you know, I just want to try to do some preventative stuff and just make sure that I, you know, have things like fiber, vitamin C, vitamin D, and then I have some mental stuff like ginkgo biloba, kava kava to promote calm mood, guarana for energy.
Yeah. I think part of it too is with the mental acuity is maintaining an active lifestyle. Mm-hmm. I think that was the big pitfall for my grandparents, was that they didn't maintain an active lifestyle. They weren't learning new things and building new neural pathways. They were just sitting at home watching like Fox News, playing Pinochle, and doing some stuff for the local HOA in the like old folks community that they had lived in before they had to go to actual homes. My grandma used a typewriter. That's never learned how to use a computer. Mm-hmm. Landline. And on the flip side, my maternal grandmother is 90 now, and she can use a smartphone. She calls me all the time. She likes my like reels on Instagram. You know, she watches Jeopardy. I think that's a big piece of it is staying active and not being stagnant.
And it could just be not even physically active, but just, you know, mentally active, like you're saying, like learning something or going on trips or doing something that kind of takes you out of the normal like comfort zone or everything that you're in.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's probably both physical and mental as well. I'm sure there's a lot of crossover there. But I don't know. Do you have any memory loss in your family?
Oh yeah, my grandmother,
like somebody degenerate like that.
My grandmother was like that. Like she couldn't, like they came and gave her a memory test. Like they start like 2 minutes before they had her write down the time. You know, mm-hmm. try to remember the time. Then they asked her another question. Then they asked her what time it was again, and she just completely was unaware.
Right. That's the delayed verbal recall test. It's the same thing that they had. I know the Trump doing his cognitive test when he was bragging about person, woman, man, camera, TV as like the five mm-hmm. words he had to remember. It's scary. I can't picture. Because I could probably get five words, remember them for years or something like that, like some specific string of things. I used to memorize pi, like digits of pi. So for that to vanish, for you not to be able to make any of those connections, I don't know. And I don't know how cognizant a person is of it, like whether you're aware of the loss or not, or to what degree you are.
Yeah, because I mean, at some points, I think you're aware, but you then re-remember and you're like, oh, got it. Yeah. It may not be immediate, but it's like, oh. That is this. Okay, got it.
I could picture it being very frustrating too, especially in the moments of lucidity, kind of recognizing that you are missing a mm-hmm. piece.
For me, it's just kind of things like I used to remember, like, you know, football players and, you know, where they went to college and things like that. Like, I can remember most of them, but then it's like you don't think about it for a while. It's like, did that information go away mm-hmm. because I was too busy, you know, thinking about other things or working on jokes now. So did my joke writing?
Yeah.
Or is it still there somewhere and I just don't know it and it's just going to, you know, pop out at some random time?
I think that's the case. Like sometimes when I'm doing joke writing and like I'm working on a bit that I haven't done yet about my experience growing up particularly in my church. And I was like just small bits and pieces and memories just fully coming to the front of my mind that I otherwise didn't think of and didn't think I had, but suddenly like I start going down that pathway. And then I think even in your brain, neurologically, like when you start doing that, then you start getting these other branches. You're like, oh yeah, wait, that thing was part of that thing. You know, like, oh yeah, that happened here, that happened there. So I think a lot of that stuff lies in the brain. It's just hard to access it. Just because if we were always constantly accessing all of our memories, I think that would hurt.
Yeah. It's just one of those things where it's very interesting to see, you know, just where, you know, if it is happening or if it isn't, what can you do to kind of, you know, restore it and just.
Yeah. Trying to think if I had the opportunity. Have you seen Black Mirror?
Yes.
There's that one episode where they have the kind of retinal, those contact lenses that record their whole life and you can like watch back and play back everything. I think that would be nice to have. I think it would be really great to revisit memories like that. I know like Elon Musk is trying to do the whole Neuralink thing.
Yeah.
But I don't know if I really want to become a cybernetic human, but I don't know.
It's hard to say because I mean, there's a fear of dying and things like that. So does that, you know, what does that do for your, like, who wants to live forever? I don't know if I would.
Oh, no, definitely not. Definitely not. And I wonder if, like, we just reached a point, you know, in human development where it's very like the ship of Theseus, where, like, each part of the ship is rebuilt. Mm-hmm. And to the point, like, is it the same vessel anymore? Like, are you the same vessel? Because I know a lot of, like, futurists and people that, you know, research these kind of things, talk about a future where we have fully cybernetic, fully integrated with technology, can like upload, download memories and things like that, fully interact with things with your mind. And at the same time though, I really prefer being natural and nature and feeling things and feeling life. Cause I feel like if you cheat death, then life becomes less valuable in a way.
Yes. That's my thought too. It's like you it's the horror of like the Green Mile, which is, you know, that Tom Hanks is destined to live forever, even, you know, outlived his children. And, you know,
yeah,
like he doesn't know when he's going to die because the mouse that the guy saved is still alive.
Yes. Yes.
He's like, this is my punishment for letting him die.
Yeah. I'll let my dork show here. There's a Doctor Who character, like the face of Bo. He interacts somehow with Doctor Who's TARDIS, his time machine, like the energy from it. And so he lives forever. And like at one point in the time space continuum, like you meet him like billions of years in the future. He used to be just a dude and now he's like a giant head in a jar. I don't know. I think, yeah, some of the beauty in human life is the fact that you are on Earth for a short period of time and the impact you can make is great, but at the same time, minimal in an infinite world. So got way more philosophical about that than I really intended memory loss.
But I mean, that's something, again, that you know, you try to understand and learn and figure out. So have you talked to your wife about it in any shape or form?
You know, I have told her in the past, I've been known to tell her that if I lose my memory significantly, that I would be fine with, you know, euthanasia or like a self-assisted, you know, like in Oregon, how they've got for like terminal hospice patients and stuff like that, how they will, you know, assisted
put you
suicide.
Asleep.
Yeah, put me to sleep. Yeah. Like a little yeller or something. Probably not, though. I don't know if in reality I would do that. I don't know if I'll have a family or something that I feel obligated to stick around for. But yeah, I've talked to her about it. I don't know entirely what her family's history of memory loss is like, but yeah, it even comes, like, it affects how my desire to have children. Mm-hmm. Just how knowing not only will I, sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. I was going to say how so.
Yeah. So, just alongside all these, I have a lot of medical problems, mental health issues. I'm carrying this hereditary gene for Alzheimer's. The universe, the world is somewhat collapsing in many ways. You know, do I even want to bear kids or have kids? Mm-hmm. I've thought about adoption or something like that. That way I kind of maybe maneuver around some of the pitfalls of my personal genetics, but who's to say?
But I mean, you know, that's something that you and, you know, that's something I guess you and your missus will, you know, really have to contemplate and things like that, just to, because it's still just, even though that does it, just because it may be in the cards for some people in your family, doesn't mean it's in your cards.
That's true. And I think there's testing you can do to identify that. But to some degree, do I even want to know all of my genetic problems? Like,
yeah,
it could be helpful to have labels, but it also could just create more anxiety for a person who already has extreme anxiety.
That's why I would say just go ahead. And if you do want to have kids, have kids. I mean, you're, unfortunately, you know, life is you can't manufacture. So you can only create naturally. You can't manufacture all the good things that you have
yet.
Yeah.
And it's like a Gattaca universe.
Yeah. But I mean, to try to manufacture or just try to take the good traits doesn't, there are some bad traits that are, you know, that are honorable or something that you could, you know, indeed, if we're passed on, you could see somebody, your next in line, basically resolve them. It's almost like you're giving them your problem and they're able to fix it. And it could be amazing to watch, just to watch some other kid where maybe you were bullied or just kind of your act out was to do entertainment and all the other things to try to get, they could basically be just the naturally gifted person that's you know, able to connect a room or to be the popular kid.
Yeah, that is true. And I hadn't really, you know, thought so much of it that way. And I think that kind of ties to the point about the shortness of life being beautiful. But part of life as well is overcoming some of these issues. And perhaps it would be silly to deny a future little Tim, you know, existence just because of my fears, you know, because they would be their own individual and they could rise past that. And I could teach them what I know, which I suppose is the really kind of whole point of having progeny.
Yeah. It's always something that's super, like, it's scary, but at the same time, it's also a comfort to just have people that constantly, you know, love and care for you.
Yeah. And then I also, you know, you get the selfishness of they can, you know, care for you in your old age and you don't have to worry about, you know, dying alone in a home, which I feel like is another big part of the fear for me as well. Mm-hmm. Just like being in a nursing home, in a memory care facility, like wasting away on a bed in a room with like a window, disconnected from family and friends, or they've all died or something. And I'm just the last one left, just like slowly wasting away and forgetting everything that I once cared about.
Yeah.
Except I'll remember like bits, probably. I'll remember like stupid, like randomly I'll just be sitting there and like, oh, here's a dumb joke I wrote 70 years ago.
But I just, you know, that's why, you know, like the comedy videos and comedy, you know, I'm recorded a comedy album and things like that, just to kind of have that compendium to sit there and like, maybe I don't have, you know, physical children, but I have the children of my, of the things that I was able to do in life. Yeah.
Of my rap album,
yeah,
you know, of my poetry, I'm still leaving something, and that's my biggest desire, I think, in the world, anyways, is being able to to leave it slightly different, at least at some level, at some scale, than how I found it. And I do that through education, although you don't necessarily see the returns as quickly. But it is really cool to have a student come back to you, like a former student. They'll come visit and go, "Oh, yeah, Mr. Davies, this and that. I really love this lesson you did or this thing." It is cool to see that impact. It'd be terrible to forget about it, but at the same time, there's solace in that.
Yeah, absolutely. There's solace and satisfaction and doing something with your life that you can kind of, I guess, relate to or be proud of.
Yeah.
Well, Tim, this has been like an awesome conversation. Where can people find you on social media if they wanted to either hear your rap or your comedy?
So you can find me at timdaviesmedia.com or Tim Davies Media on all the different social media platforms. And you can listen to my podcast on Spotify. It's called Shift Space. And I do that with my friend Anthony Heinderman.
Awesome. So is it only on...
It is actually wherever Anchor FM distributes.
Okay.
And I think I really want to get on Apple as well, because I know that's got the highest viewership or listenership, rather, of podcasts.
To do that, I would just say when you go in there, just, you know, it takes a few days for Apple. So that's the only rub, is like that was the one that was the longest for me to get enrolled in. I think I'm on Spotify, Google, Apple, and all those. But
yeah,
it was... They said you see, a week before you go live, go ahead and register for Apple Podcasts so that they... Mm.
Good to know. Well, thank you for having me, Ryan.
Yeah, thanks again, Tim. So that was Tim. That was a fun conversation. Like, I really enjoyed talking about all the mental health, the teaching, and learning about the different ways we educate kids these days. Like, it's just so different from when I was a kid. I feel like maybe that's... you know, how it may have been for my parents, but it just seems like it's a whole different level now with the technology and things that kids have nowadays, like just not even having pencil and paper. Like when we were kids and our parents were kids, we had pencil, paper, and writing, and now it's typing and, you know, just making presentations and things like that, and just discussing. And so much stuff is more centralized and kind of fit to the child to see how they best learn. So check out Tim Davies at Tim Davies Media. That's TimDavies Media on all social media platforms. He's a rising star in the Dallas comedy scene. I'm sure he's going to, you know, make his way here in the near future. Also, you can check me out at Ryan Perio. Also, if you like what you hear, leave a review for the show. We love getting reviews. It's going to be an interesting week. It's the 4th of July. I didn't do a lot of stand-up this week. I only did one show at Hyenism Fort Worth in the Red Room. But Friday night, I actually, because of COVID, had to, I guess, lend my voice to the show as far as starting the show at Hyenism Fort Worth in the main stage with J.R. Brow, Thomas Nichols, and Arun. And that was such a fun, stressful time. Like, it was really cool just to kind of be in the background and just watching. Like, it was one of these weekends where I just kind of watched people and then on the ride home just questioned everything I did, just to kind of, where can I get better is what I kind of just thought in my mind. Like, what can I do to be a better comic, a better person, things of that nature. Like, maybe not as much better person as much as a better comic, but I strive to be better and do better at everything I do. So check out J.R. Brow. He'll be in Hyenas, Dallas this weekend. This weekend, I have nothing on the books just yet. Next weekend, I am doing my own show creation called The Joke Machine, which is something I learned from a podcast from Maria Bamford and Jackie Cashin, is that they write together, and the writing process they have takes some rules from improv. So whatever they write, that's what it has to be. So if they write about going to the doctor, it has to be going to the doctor. They can't change that scenario. And then they just kind of flesh things out by asking questions about the doctor's office. What's the doctor look like? And it just kind of helps you write, hopefully, a better a better bit. So hopefully that show will be going on. We'll have that at the Dallas Comedy Club the 16th of July. So check that out. It's on, should be on their website here shortly. Thank you guys again so much for listening to this. I hope you guys have a happy and safe 4th of July. I know it's been a really, really rough go these last couple weeks with the Supreme Court decision and things like that. Just a lot of unhappiness and just conflict between everybody, just kind of a personal and everywhere else. So have a safe 4th. Still, you know, try to love one another, and we, you know, we'll do our best to get along in this country. It's not perfect, but I believe we can be better, and hopefully we will be. Thanks again for listening to the Sum of All Fears podcast. Have a wonderful week. And now some thank yous for the folks that make this show possible. Thanks to Barry Whitewater for my art and graphics. You can follow him on Instagram at bwhite2o. Get it? H2O, like water. You can also follow him on Facebook. Music. A huge thank you to Gunnar Olson for the wonderful music provided for this podcast. You can follow him on Instagram at gunbuns. That's G-U-N-B-U-N-S. As well as his website, gunnarolson.net. Check out some of the samples that he has recorded. They're amazing. He's an amazing percussionist. If you want to follow the show, we've got a Facebook group, Some of All Fears. Instagram, Twitter, you can find us at Some Fear Fans. If you have some feedback for the show, email me at somefearfans, somefearfans, at gmail.com. I'll be happy to take those into consideration. Also, if you'd like to be a guest, email me at somefearfans@gmail.com. We can try to iron out some details and get that settled in. You know, give us some feedback if on Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts, leave a review. It makes the show bigger, and it's not going anywhere. I'm going to record as many shows as I possibly can. If you want to follow me on social media, I am at Ryan Perrio. It's RyanPerrio on all social media platforms. You can follow me there, and you can check me out at RyanPerrio.com, my website. I'll try to list upcoming shows there as well. It's been kind of spotty because as soon as I set it up, that's when the pandemic happened, and everything's kind of just in a holding pattern. Thanks again for listening to the Sum of All Fears podcast. Next week, we'll have another guest with another fear. Thanks for listening.